Good morning, Ellen Fanning with you for Life Matters this Anzac Day. It's a day for two up, a time for remembering. Legacy has been around for decades. It's well known around Australia for its promise to look after the missus and the kids of Australian soldiers who make the ultimate sacrifice for their country. Well, in keeping with this commitment, modern legacy has expanded its role to care for the dependents of veterans who return home suffering from physical or psychological injuries. But what kind of care do they offer? To tell us more about the care Legacy provides is Lisa Kwok, a Legacy ambassador and partner of Jamie Tanner, a medically discharged soldier. Good morning, Lisa. Start off by telling me, when did you meet Jamie?
I was organising a Remembrance Day service a few years ago at my work, and I needed to find a speaker who was an Afghanistan veteran because it was 10 years since Australia had been involved in Afghanistan. And somebody suggested Jamie, so he came along and we met. He spoke at the service and, all history from there.
What impression did he make on you to start with?
Tall and good-looking. Yes. So, no, really good, really well held together.
Yeah.
Young, strong and proud veteran is what really came across, particularly, when he delivered that speech. We also read during the service the Afghanistan Honour Roll, which I think at that stage had 39 names on it. And he actually lost 10 of his friends during the Afghanistan campaign. So, it was actually very moving to see him standing there holding his hand over his medals as the names were read out and watching the tears come down his face. And that really did make an impression on me, but also on everyone else who was there watching.
And what did he say that day about his wartime experiences?
He spoke about why he joined the army and the funny reason was so he didn't have to do Year 12 at school. Because he went in at 17, so at the end of year 11. And he just talked about the experience of, learning in infantry, but also the mateship and the bonds that he built with his fellow soldiers, and talked about the experiences, but all in positive terms of knowing that what they did when each time they went overseas was for a really good reason, but also talking about the supporting one another, watching each other's backs, and just again the story of mateship and the bonds that were built.
So you go on the first date. Tell me about that first date.
The first date was interesting.
That's an interesting word in itself.
Yes, it is. We were heading to Byron Bay up to a restaurant there, and it was a Friday night. We were driving from Ballina to Byron, which is only about a half an hour drive, and he was asking questions about work and starting to get quite agitated. And we got halfway there and he turned around and actually dropped me back home, and we didn't actually end up going out.
Oh.
And I thought, okay, this is different. So we tried again a few days later, went up to the restaurant we were heading to at Byron Bay. And when we got there, they were about to show us a table, and he insisted that we sat at the table in the corner, which at the time I thought, oh, okay, well, maybe he particularly likes that table. And as we were walking over, he's looking around everywhere. And then we sat down, and he spent the whole conversation not making eye contact, but looking around at everything. That tended to be how it went for a couple of dates, and it worked out after a few that there was one in particular we had to leave halfway through because he just wasn't he was feeling very, very uncomfortable. And on the way to dropping me home, I asked him what was going on, and I'm really, really lucky. I count myself in retrospect to be incredibly lucky, because he opened up and he started to talk to me, and he told me what was going on in his head. He told me about why he needs to drive, because when he was in Iraq, he was one of the drivers, and so it was always scanning the road, making sure what was on the side of the road was actually just harmless debris, looking for irregularities in the road. And if you know the road between Ballina and Byron Bay, it's full of potholes. You know, those types of things. He was also explaining to me why he needed to sit in the corner when he went out in public, and the reason is so he had a back to his wall, but also so he could see everything that was going on. So every time we went out, he could tell me, you know, if the staff were wearing name badges, the name of every male staff member that was in the restaurant. He could describe every male person in the restaurant. He could tell me where every exit was and how far away we were from every exit. So every time he went out in public, the hypervigilance would take hold and he would be looking around him to see if there was any dangers. So he was always in two minds. One was, well, I'm in Australia in the Northern Rivers, which is a really, really safe part of the world and nothing is going to happen here. But the other half of him was always, well, I always have to be alert. I've always got to be looking for danger and I've always got to be prepared to respond.
I'm just shocked listening to this. How did you react?
I had some experience. So I've worked with veterans for about 8 years. My experience has always been with World War II, Korea and Vietnam veterans. So from spending time with them through my work environment, I had some understanding of the reactions of war veterans in normal environments. So I'm really lucky in that I had that experience that was completely detached. So I was able to be aware that, okay, for a veteran, this is quite normal. But yeah, it was also processing on, okay, how is this going to impact us? Mm. And how is this going to impact my family and my children?
But this is a huge amount to take in. Here is a man who cannot help but have a battle plan for a date.
Yes.
This is a man who was eventually medically discharged.
Correct.
With post-traumatic stress disorder, sent back into the community. How did he go with just ordinary things like going to the shopping centre?
He still struggles with that. So he would, for the first 2 years after discharge, he self-medicated with alcohol.
And he didn't get counselling for this?
No, not in the beginning. You know, the hardest thing first is recognising that you do need help, and then the second hardest thing is actually asking for that help.
So if you're stressed out and you're hypervigilant and really stressed out, these are high levels of stress, surely you can't hold this together day after day. Do you melt down every now and again?
Well, we call them meltdowns. So every now and then there is the possibility of a meltdown. One thing that we're really lucky with Jamie and our family is that he's actually very, very aware of when he's reaching the point where he can't control or handle the situation any longer.
And what does a meltdown look like?
Well, he leaves.
He leaves your family home?
Yes, so he'll leave. So he will remove himself, whether it's at home or a supermarket or a restaurant or any other situation, he will remove himself from that situation to give him the space to come down, to clear his head and to reset. Because he's very conscious of the fact that if you're in that state, there may be things that you say that can't be taken back. Mm. And there may be things that you do that cannot be undone. So his coping mechanism is that he leaves.
Well, how long does he go for?
Oh, sometimes it can be an hour. Other times it could be days.
And I imagine that the Veterans Affairs stands ready to help him with counselling. Would that be right?
Yes, so he actually has very regular counselling through VVCS, the Veterans and Veterans Families Counselling Service, and he's had very, very positive experiences through our local office here in Lismore.
Okay, so now we come to you and the kids. He's gone, you don't know how long for. You've got a job, the kids have got lives. Tell us about legacy and tell us about Margaret.
So about 2 years ago, I learnt that Legacy actually changed their charter to help the families of veterans who had given their health. Previously to that, I thought that it was just for the war widows and that's all, but I learnt that, no, it was actually veterans who gave their health as well, which Jamie falls into that category. Legacy for our family has been an absolute lifesaver. I don't know what we would do without them. Our legatee, her name is Margaret, she is worth her weight in gold. She acts, so she's kind of like a surrogate nana and a surrogate mum for me. So she's someone that I can call at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Really?
If I need to, and just either offload, or I can call and say, you know, we're in crisis, I need you. And, you know, if she's available, she'll come. You know, she has a wonderful relationship with the kids. So, you know, she does, she's there for crisis, but she also has built a wonderful relationship with the kids. So she, every now and then she'll pick them up from school and take them out for afternoon tea and an activity. She might take them to the movies or bowling or just hanging out at her house with her family.
She's a safe person they can talk to.
Exactly. So she's built this relationship with the kids. The kids just love her. And it means that if something were to happen in the middle of the night, so whether it was Jamie melted down and disappeared and I went looking for him, or he was sick or in that much pain, I need to take him to the hospital, then I can ring Margaret. The kids wake up in the morning. If they see Margaret in the house, they know everything's okay. They know that they're going to be okay. She also communicates to the kids about what's going on in a really age-appropriate level that makes them feel safe and secure.
How old's Margaret?
She would be early 60s, I think. I've never asked the question.
And she has a particular empathy for your situation, yes, because she was a legacy kid herself. Dad,
yes,
was a veteran.
So her father served as well, and passed away from his injuries. So
which war?
World War II, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
So when she retired from her work life and decided that she would spend her time volunteering, she naturally chose legacy because it was something that was close to her heart, but also something that she had had a positive experience from as well. And we're very grateful that she decided to choose legacy to be the charity that she volunteers for.
Mm. And so what's your message to other young veterans and their families who are living with the sort of pain you've described?
One of the biggest things is that, particularly when things are incredibly bad and everything is black, it's so overwhelmingly isolating. And you also have this overwhelming feeling of helplessness as well. The thing that I've learnt over the last 2 years with us being involved with Legacy is that we're actually not as alone as we thought we were. Mm. And there are people who are there to help us get through the little things, but also get through the really big things. And for us, Margaret is there for the really good times, but she's also there for the really bad times. So she's actually become a part of our family. Mm. And it's just knowing that we've got someone there who is there to help with this part of our lives, the part of our lives that we also often really can't talk to our families about sometimes.
And that's a wonderful legacy right there, isn't it?
Certainly is.
Lisa Kwok, talking about the role of modern legacy, not just for war widows these days. More than 6,000 volunteers like Margaret are working in the community right now. Have a look at their website for more information or contact your local branch, www.legacy.com.au. Fred Smith travelled to Afghanistan for the Department of Foreign Affairs as a political advisor, engaging the provincial government officials and the tribal chiefs. He travelled with a guitar and he wrote this song called Coming Home, inspired by his experiences working with soldiers in Afghanistan.
Underneath these northern stars, picking on a mate's guitar, with a breeze from Kandahar blowing soft and warm. See, my own is in its case, with the movers just off base, on a pallet bound for space. Now I'm going home. Fighting season got underway after harvest back in May, with a tax in Chachanay and Charmerstone. But the checkpoints all have held, it wasn't pretty, but oh well. Let them do it all themselves, now let's go home. Don't get out too much these days with the bass in retrograde. This trip hasn't been the guns of Navarone. And nothing like my first go round out in the valleys round for round. 40 good men in the ground, now we're gone. And up on cobble streets I hear they've got billboards everywhere of the Lion of Panshir or a 3G phone. Meanwhile down here in TK they're banking on NK and the Fighting 4th Brigade, cause we're going home. I don't know how I'm gonna fit back home. Been out here now so long, this is what I know. Brother, thanks for your ear. Life is easier out here. It's loving family I fear. Now I'm gone home. Hear the mullah sing his song at the rising of the sun. Shares his love for everyone through a megaphone. By the time this sings again, I'll be on that bird, my friend. This war is at an end, now I'm gone home.
Fred Smith and the track Coming Home. Today, a dose of honesty from the medical coalface. From midnight to dawn, while most of us are asleep in bed, Dr. Gordian Fulda is running one of Australia's busiest emergency departments. He's been Director of Emergency at St. Vincent's Hospital in Sydney for more than three decades. And basically, this is a man who has seen it all. Dr. Fulda is also the 2016 Senior Australian of the Year. He gave a talk at the Australian Human Rights Commission recently, which we recorded for Life Matters. He begins by talking about the impact the controversial lockout laws in King's Cross have had on the cases he sees coming into emergency. Are they working? Here's Dr. Gordian Fulda.
From Friday night at 6 p.m. to Sunday morning at 6 a.m, we had a 24.8% decrease in critically severely injured patients. Boys will never stop being boys. People won't stop being drunk. The cavemen, as soon as they found some fermenting honey, they got drunk and probably beat each other up. But what has stopped is the really horrible, disabling, nasty violence on the footpaths. I think that's something which is really a good thing. This is from the Police Bureau of Statistics, Crime and Research. There were 21% less sexual assaults. We have no idea, because of the change in regulations in the first year or so after they came in, what the decrease in domestic violence. I've rarely seen a domestic violence incident where alcohol wasn't involved. Now, the reality is that's what the regulations were trying to achieve, that there weren't these very intoxicated, out-of-control people roaming the streets in the wee small hours of the morning. Good stuff. Less work, less people injured, less people... Because, I mean, if you just get a slight knock to the head, you already, your brain cells and a little bit of concussion, you have subtle changes which go on for ages. And if you get knocked harder to the head, it also includes sports and all that sort of stuff, you know, that change could nearly... Well, it can be permanent. Basically, ladies are being targeted because, unfortunately, ladies used to be so much more sensible than us stupid males. The ladies now have caught up and catching up quickly to the male drinking patterns. There's some research from America. Having one drink doubles your risk of going to emergency. After 10 drinks, now that's not hard to do. People going out, schoolboys going, having 10 beers and they're well over, under 18. 10 is, on a Saturday night, is not a big number. And they've got tenfold risk. A woman's risk after 10 drinks, and remember, ladies usually metabolise alcohol not as fast, it goes up to 14. That's not good risk ratios. Okay, here's some pickies of what we have. That actually is a slash in the right-hand side of the patient's abdomen. Was done with a samurai sword. People under normal thought control don't do stuff like that. This I put there because this is so real. Alcohol is a depressant, and most mornings when I do my ward rounds, there are two or three people who are suicidal, self-harmed, because they've been unhappy. What do? They drink alcohol, that makes you even more depressed, and they really get into a bad, bad spot. So alcohol, it's sort of one of the things where we're only starting to talk about it, but we need to talk about it a lot more, and that includes young people. We think young people are bulletproof, they can go to the beach and chase whatever, boys or girls, whatever they want to chase, but there's a heap of depression out there, and alcohol makes it really dangerous. And the other thing that happens is when people are not able to judge or take good decisions, they get run over. They're going for a taxi. Yes, that's a problem. Transport out of, you know, drinking places, entertainment precincts. We definitely haven't got anywhere near right. But they just don't judge. And before you know it, our cities are getting more cars. Drivers are getting much more impatient. It was all based on the Newcastle, well, project, what they call. It was wildly successful because the hoteliers, the people, the community all got together. Everybody ever been Hunter Street in the old days? It was a zoo. It was a mining town. Guys, you know, it was rough. Anyway, that's what they got when they did it. 57% reduction in assaults, 26% reduction in the assaults going to emergency department. Good stuff. That means hospitals, nurses, doctors, resources, let alone the troubles and tribulations later were much less. Binge drinking will always be with us. I think it'll take a generation or two. My personal point of view is the role models, the parents, the aunties, the uncles, the Saturday afternoon barbecue, when somebody wins a football match, all that sort of stuff. We've got to change what the young people are seeing so they think, well, maybe this is not a good look, and they don't feel they have to do it for peer pressure. The Australian College for Emergency Medicine did a SNAP survey. Now, this is really current. It's this year, and it was double the rate, more than double the rate of people presenting on Australia Day. So people, Australians, like to celebrate, and when we celebrate it, we don't do it in a sensible fashion. Nobody's saying prohibition. Nobody's saying stop, no drinking, all that sort of stuff. No, you can drink. Just take it easy. This is the policy from the Australian College of Emergency Medicine. There's a whole lot of research going. We got a grant from the NH and MRC, and basically there's two main things there. In other words, we've got to get much better data. A lot of this debate would fizzle out if we had robust scientific data. We just don't have it. Our computer systems and what we do in hospitals just aren't set. They're basically injury-specific. You know, if you've got a broken arm, we really don't know if you've got a broken arm and alcohol was involved or whatever. So that has to change, and it will change. And the other thing that is going to be done is a short... When we have people in the emergency department, the patient is vulnerable. And the thing is, it's been shown on other things, lifestyle issues, that in that moment, just a very brief, not a sort of thou shalt not, thou art a bad person, but, you know, well, how do you feel about your drinking, mate? You know, this is a good thing. And you just have a couple of sentences and it works. Okay, ice. Do we have a problem? I think there's a wild guess out there. I'm going to hit you with more stats, which scare the hell out of me. Australia has the highest proportion of recreational drug users in the world, and repeatedly so. I mean, the big question is why, but it's a reality. We're number one in the world for ecstasy. Per population. We're number three in the world for ice or crystal meth. A really, really nasty, nasty, damaging drug. The National Ice Task Force, okay, reported in this not long ago in a medical journal, Australia, in that article there, is that the pattern use has increased, more regular use, greater levels of dependent use, and it's the largest number ever, an increasing of people using ice. Ice is the most profitable drug you can make. The precursors are easily come by. Not long ago, you just order a 44-gallon drum from India or something, and on the internet, and the amount of money to be made is massive. It's all about money. But the nexus between mental health and ice and drug taking is massive. It really is. The paranoia they get, that's why they go absolutely berserk. And when they really believe that somebody's out to kill them, do this or that, they lock themselves in their house, their family can't get them out. And we have that every day. And it's not just St. Vincent's. Rural Australia, Indigenous Australia are high-risk areas where this is just absolutely destroying communities. And the age group is still young, from 15 to 34. In other words, these are the people you can nearly say that are our future. You know, the people who are getting ready to do their HSC, go to uni, go to trades, whatever, make a family, if that's what they want to do. The destruction starts. The thing is, being a doctor is a very privileged thing. But you have moral codes. Nobody really takes a Hippocratic Oath per se. It's a voluntary thing by some universities. But your focus is the patient. So when there's an intermeshing between the law and the patient and all that sort of thing, and that is very difficult. And with drugs, one's got to be very, very careful. The law is not always very clear on it. For instance, to the best of my knowledge, if we find a whole lot of drugs on a person who's become unconscious, we have no right to confiscate that drug. That's their personal property. Only police or court orders can do that. And then comes the, I love it, and I hope I'm not offending, I think there's a few lawyers and barristers and judges in the audience, but then there was this beautiful thing that people like me can't understand. They say the doctor has to decide whether the amount of drugs is an indictable offence which brings with it a custodial sentence. I'm supposed to know this little bag of pills that this person had stuffed down their underpants on the way to a music festival. You know, what the hell does that mean? Chances are that those pills will accidentally wander down the toilet or something. I don't know. They get lost.
The doctors have to decide whether the amount of drugs is an indictable offence? That's interesting. We're bringing you a talk that Dr. Gordian Fulder, Senior Australian of the Year, gave recently about his work heading up one of Australia's busiest emergency departments. Let's return now to that talk and hear him take some questions about his work and the law in the area of drug and alcohol abuse.
First of all, it is insanely healthy we're having a debate. We're also in the age of social media, which is sort of a bit hard because it can be very unbalanced and all that thing. But like I said, unless society, communities have their say or feel they have their say, it's not going to work. There is two cues. There are. I went to a private school, so my English is whatever. There are two QCs from Queensland who are looking at it objectively. I don't know what they're going to find. But one of the big things really is every action has a consequence. It's what we try and teach our kids and whatever. Every action has gone. Yes, there are people who have lost money, livelihoods, etc., etc. There's no such thing as one silver bullet will just fix everything and everything be wonderful. The debate has to be out there, but obviously from an observational health point of view, the having footpaths that are safe for people not to be punched out, not to be kicked, not to run out in front of traffic. As I say, the misery from that is just indescribable. Society has to work out, do they want to pay a price for that?
My question relates to the lockout laws. So when the lockout laws came in, there were a lot of people critiqued them as being quite a knee-jerk reaction to some powerful lobbying and media coverage. I guess the opposition has probably grown even stronger since then. And you mentioned before that the current model is perhaps not the best model or the most sustainable. You mentioned that the last drinks are at 3 a.m. and the public transport is limited. Trains don't start again until 5:30, etc. So do you think that the really strong opposition that has been created by like a knee-jerk reaction, do you think that will become a hindrance in trying to actually develop and implement a better revised model down the track?
Very simply, if one uses the medical model, heaven forbid, but if you get sick, you and I have a chat what the best form of treatment is. Like, I've got the lurgy at the moment, I'm on antibiotics, da-da-da. The greatest weakness in all this is we don't know what works. A whole lot of things happened. There is so many things happening in King's Cross, from scanners to the lockouts to this and that, no shots before midnight, all this sort of thing. What really has to happen, and it'll take time, it'll take money, is to what actually works in that environment. Whatever happened or works in King's Cross or the CBD may not, well, almost definitely won't be what works in a country town. So that's what's missing. The science and all this is missing. And then it gets put to the people and say, this is what it is. We can say, well, if we do this, great likelihood that this will be the result, right? It has been a bit of a shotgun, but it was the best they could do going off in an Australian town. This is not taking it from America or Europe or whatever. Newcastle was a very, still is, haven't succeeded, have I? Very, very Australian town, and people honestly did what they thought would work. And almost certainly there has to be adjustments. And and it's a work in progress. It has to be.
Why doesn't the government, by the recommendation of doctors, because you come across all the tragedy, and to make the laws which drinking timing is restricted, say, I think up to midnight, it's okay if person drinks. After that, it should be illegal. It should be a crime. And the similar time, they have to apart. I mean, to save lives, to save so much of expense, which is going in a bad way, which can be used for so many good purposes.
First of all, people have got to want it. That's what I keep saying. The other thing, there are international cities, west coast of America, LA, Ireland, who are good drinkers. I love a stout myself. They also have 2 o'clock. This is what I was getting at. We need to put a risk ratio. Just saying 12 o'clock, stop drinking, is not tenable, right? It really is in our society, in my opinion. It's just not tenable. And the really very, very fundamental issue here that overrides everything else, if fairy godmother landed here, what I'd like to have is that people drink sensibly. That's what it's about. When people are in a venue, I have my RSA, Responsible Service of Alcohol, card and all that sort of thing. Nobody's stopping anybody drinking, but we just don't want people drinking to excess, getting themselves injured, getting others injured for the sake of being drunk. Prohibition, all that thing is a disaster, never should happen. It's just like war on drugs. But it really has to be measured, worked out, what we're doing. But the final thing that'll cure all this and settle it all, I mean, there's so many cultures in the world, they don't have the problem we have in Australia. They really don't. In Europe, you can go into a petrol station and buy wine, liquor, all this sort of thing. There's the famous story of an Australian person who went to Paris to work, right, on a Friday afternoon. Everybody said, oh, let's go down and have a glass of some wine or something, right? A couple of glasses. And anyway, after a couple of glasses, the French people all got up and went home, and the Australian was still sitting there going, what's going on? It's Friday afternoon. It's a cultural thing, right? But in the end, we have to think. There's some good things coming through. Once again, these are on surveys, so they're, once again, scientifically not that robust, but there's the best we have. The younger people is in the 14-year-old and less. There's less binge drinking than there was before, so maybe something's getting through. But in the end, it's the individual has to not want to do something stupid. I mean, one of my personal litmus tests, I'm going to get into trouble with this, what do people want for their teenage children? That really, when it comes down, it's like we try and treat patients, if they were a loved one in hospital, doesn't matter if they're, you know, living rough and don't smell good. I mean, what would you want your teenage children to do in the environment they're going to grow up in? That's the big one.
Firstly, I'd like to agree with you that what we need is a cultural change. I've spent quite a bit of time in both France and Italy. They don't have a drinking problem. And there's something wrong with our culture. And it comes back to the number of women who are killed, the domestic violence. But the question, you made a comment there, you said prohibition doesn't work. So what are we going to do about drugs? Because that is a purely prohibition approach and it's not working.
I hate using the word and it sounds like I'm whizzing out of it, but it's a multifactorial approach. I mean, you cannot just use law and order against anything, drugs, alcohol, whatever. Right? It won't work. It has to also be the medical model where the patient has a problem. I mean, young people don't say, oh, when I grow up, I want to be an alcoholic, or, oh, I want to be an ice head. No, it's sort of, there's a whole lot of stuff that's going on there. And that's where we, in the medical thing, I think a medical model is a bloody good start in it saying, why are people turning to drugs? Why do they need to alter reality? Why do they need to take drugs and beat up their family, their mothers and fathers and all that sort of stuff? Anybody who knows a crystal meth family, it is horrible. Really, all the love and everything just doesn't turn many of these kids around, and there is no silver bullet. I don't think there's a machine gun of silver bullets.
Gordy and I know each other. I'm Thomas Kelly's mother, so I know what it's like to live through the tragedy of losing a child or losing someone that you love. But I think I just wanted to make a statement that what we need is we need strong governments. And until we have strong bipartisan agreements amongst our governments, and we're talking not about just a state level, but at a federal level, we will not see change. And cultural change is going to take a great deal of time. It's not going to be in my generation, but I truly hope that there is cultural change by the time my children have their children. And we're talking 15, 20 years before we can see this change. But without community support, without people that are prepared to stand up and have a say and say they're not prepared to accept the violence that is carrying on in our country at the moment due to drugs, due to alcohol, domestic and non-domestic violence, until we have our strength of our communities, we will not get governments to create that change. And that change has been seen. It's been changed in the smoking community. It's been changed by children not being able to drive on, or anybody able to drive, with pee plates, with alcohol in their breath. So we do need to stand as a community. We need to force our government's hand, and we need to see bipartisan agreement to tackle the effects, particularly of alcohol in our country, because people just don't seem to understand the harms.
One of my favourite hope, whatever, I wasn't born, but world wars. How did we reward our soldiers? We sent them cigarettes, right? To think about it. You're ducking bullets and we give you coffin nails. Yeah. And then slowly, as it became scientifically evident that smoking causes cancer, causes laryngeal, all that sort of stuff, and good evidence was put in front of everyday people aren't stupid. And they realise, I don't want to take this risk. I don't know. This is not good. I don't want this for my children. And that's when it'll happen. In other words, the tipping point. We're not quite there yet we're far away off it, with alcohol. Because with all those numbers, chronic, unhealthy alcohol intake rots the whole body. But the hospitals have lots and lots of these patients. But it's not, I won't say sexy or as dramatic as teenagers killing each other sort of stuff. But once this comes out, and I think this is what's going to happen, my prediction, crystal ball, in the next 5 to 10 years, there's going to be a lot of information which hopefully will allow the population to say, there's a better way.
I've lived with a father who's an alcoholic, so I found this really interesting. As a high school student, I just wanted to hear your comment. Do you feel that we need to bring more, like, strong and some of those images back to, you know, my sister's here in primary school? like a stronger influence and idea about educating at a younger level, like, you know, the Department of Education, do they need to team up with other organisations to put a stronger emphasis on teaching young people all this information?
Yeah, okay, you're on the money. In the end, we've got to know who young people look up to. It's their elder brothers, sisters. If it's a male child, dad's the hero. Female, it's mum. Until maybe they become teenagers, then they become enemies, whatever. But the thing is, and then it's the sports people, it's all this sort of thing. So there's a whole lot of stuff in there has to be. I personally think if you go up to a teenager nowadays, a 15-year-old, I do a lot of school talks and whatever, but they're usually in high school. Hand on heart, I'd say there's very few people in there, in spite of when they get totally sozzled and smashed and wasted on the weekend, don't know that it's not really a good idea. But if somebody gets drunk, 16-year-old gets drunk, and it's all seen and they come to school on Monday, they're a hero. I personally think like Healthy Harold, Life Education, who target even the very younger ones, but that's a bloody good step. But in the end, it's the nearly into utero, right? What the child is seeing, hearing, what they want to be like, you know, I'll say it, there's very good statistics that, sorry, it's not personal, but the daughter of an alcoholic is more likely to marry an alcoholic. So what's that telling you? We've got a lot of homework to do.
Dr. Gordian Fulda speaking recently at the Australian Human Rights Commission. You're listening to Life Matters.
Hi, it's Michael Cathcart here. I'm sure that there are some books that you have read again and again, and some that were so striking that you'll only need to read them once. If you could choose one book which the rest of us simply must read, what would it be? Tell us in 50 words or less, and you could win a collection of this year's must reads as chosen by the Sydney Writers Festival. All the details are on the RN homepage. Just click Sydney Writers Festival.
Here at Life Matters, we do like to leave the building occasionally and go to our guests rather than have them come to us. And so our producer, Amal Awad, has been doing a series for Life Matters on migrant stories of coming to Australia and what happened next. Recently, she made her way out to a little barbershop in the western suburbs of Sydney to talk to Sam Petrou, who came to Sydney in 1961 from Greece.
Hi, how are you, Sam?
Good to see you.
Hello. How are you?
My name is Sam Petrou, and in my professional life, I've been a barber all my life, and I'm still practicing as a barber at my age, which is 72 years of age. I was born in 1944 in a small town called Sofikon in the province of Corinth in Greece. And our family found it necessary to immigrate to Australia, same as a lot of other families at the time, to enhance their possibilities and for the future of their children.
What was your first impression of Australia, and how did that compare to what you expected in the first place?
Australia, of course, it was totally different than what we had seen aboard the ship, because aboard the ship they had movies about Australia, and mainly they used to sell homesteads and farms with ladies wearing long dresses, and they used to sell sheep, thousands and thousands of sheep and cows. And when you're getting into a city and you see that this place is habitated by a civilized society, it becomes more or less another climax, you know.
How did that feel to you as a teenage boy?
Of course, it was very exciting because when you're a teenager and you're coming from small townships and small cities in comparison to white spaces, bigger cities, and crossing the oceans, the Red Sea, and coming to Australia, I mean, it is very exciting for a 17-year-old, you know. So, you came at the right time. We've got a client here as well, because it's been a quiet time this week.
Con, how long have you been coming to Sam?
Many years.
Why do you like coming to Sam?
because they were gentlemen. They got nice, good stories.
I came here on a Monday and I started working in the barber shop at St. Peter's on Thursday.
Oh, wow. So culture shock and straight into work.
Yeah, and well, my employer was a Greek from our provinces, and he had a mixed business, a man hairdressing and ladies hairdressing. Because I was efficient in my job, he was very kind to me. He was paying me adult wages, even though I was only 17. And he had a scheme where if you did more than 20 haircuts a day, you used to get a shilling commission every extra haircut. So if you did, say, for instance, an extra 10 haircuts, you used to get 10 shillings or 10 bob, I used to call it those days. And on a 6 day a week, there was £3. 60 shillings was £3. And I used to take home nearly £23 a week, which was a phenomenal amount of money for any adult, let alone a 17-year-old. Did you see the Shelley's photograph? I bring it here with me. I bring a different photograph every day of a different time of life together because we spent so many years together. Shelley was a beautiful lady. She was Anglo-Saxon, and she had Scottish parents, and she was a divorcee, and she had a little boy at the time. And we met by chance in the midnight at the club, which used to be called the Associated Motor Club. And that's where some of the modern of the day jazz singers used to sing there, Ricky Mai and Norman Erskine, and it used to be beautiful there. And we, myself and my friend, we ventured out on a Monday night, and we met a couple of girls there on a Castle Rye Hotel, and from there on we went to Manchester, we had a couple more drinks, and we went to the restaurant, and by that time it was 11 o'clock. What do we do? Let's go to the Associated Motor Club. So we went to the third floor where the piano bar was, and all of a sudden we looked around and there was only another company with few people celebrating a birthday. And one of those people, he recognized me as being the person who cut his hair, and he invited us to go and join them. So we joined them, we became one group, and I happened to sit next to Shirley, and that was my destiny. We started talking, and one thing led to the other.
So you were actually on another date.
Well, you can call it a date. I mean, we had met two girls, yes. And at the end of the night, we exchanged telephone numbers. And
the rest, as they say, is history.
Yes, yes, yes. And been together for 48 years altogether. Sadly, she passed away 2 years ago, and I miss her terribly, but she left a long-lasting mark in my life. The mountain from a little hill, gonna build me a mountain, least I hope I will. Gonna build a when the time came for me to marry Shirley, I experienced a lot of difficulties at home because my parents had other expectations of me, to marry a Greek girl, and to find that I married a lady which was divorced with a little child and other personal issues. And, of course, the Greek Orthodox Church didn't want to know us because she was a divorcee at the time. We finished up getting married at the Westside Chapel at King's Cross. Reverend Ted Knopf, wonderful man, wonderful man. He reassured us that our love for each other will overcome all the difficulties that we were encountering. Yeah, yeah.
Interracial marriage is still a big thing for a lot of people these days, even though Australia is very multicultural. It's not easy for parents who come from a different country to accept it when their child wants to marry someone from a different culture. What was that like for you to go to your parents and say, this is the woman I want to marry, and to have them say, we don't approve?
Yes, it was devastating, actually. Devastating, because you can imagine if they had consented, how different my life would have been. I mean, we had an established business, and I had just completed a journeyman course in tech for light years hairdressing, and I was at the best of my life, 25, 26 years of age, with an incredible future ahead of me. Instead, I find myself unemployed in a shop which was virtually doing nothing for me, had no prospect. It was only years afterwards I managed to make wages in that shop. If I didn't have the other job, I wouldn't be able to make it, and that was because we sold the shop for the simple reason because if I'm going to leave home because my parents object me marrying my wife, that was never going to change my mind. How can I go to work with my dad the moment I've left home? What sort of relationship would that be? It was a very difficult time, a very difficult time. And when we got married and left home, I had a second-hand barbecue table with two chairs, second-hand fridge, and a bed, which was a second-hand bed. And the bed was the table, it was the lounge chairs, it was everything. That's all we had. In those days, there was no credit cards. You understand? And you had to go to work and save. And Shirley had to go and help me. She used to do a bit of bar work. And sadly, because of the bar work, she developed emphysema from passive smoking later on, and I've lost her. And she suffered so much for the last 10 years of her life because of the unsafe working conditions that existed those days in bar work. Young people today, they don't go to the church,
nothing.
They chose to go to the sport on Sunday.
Nothing good.
That's because...
when I come to Australia, that's beautiful.
But can't, you know, that...
not now.
When did your parents come around?
Oh, well, they eventually realized that maybe within the first 12 months they had come around, because they realized that my wife and I were living for each other and we were trying to do everything possible. Mind you, also Shirley being more mature than me, because she was nearly 12 years older than me, which was another handicap.
It was very progressive as well that time.
But obviously, you've seen the photographs, she was so beautiful that the age difference was not apparent at any stage. And because after having the first child, she developed problems that she had to have major surgery, that we couldn't have any children. And of course, that was another big handicap that I had to overcome with my parents, because my parents were expecting me to bring a child to this world that would carry, preferably if there's a boy, to carry the name of my father. When they discovered that Shirley couldn't have any children, that was even worse than anything. So
a lot of crosses.
Oh, yeah.
When you look back on your life in Australia, which is really your adulthood...
Of course, all my life, from the age of 17. Think about it, I'm 72 now. Yeah.
How do you feel about the choices that you've made in your life? And do you think you would do anything differently?
No, I had a very fulfilling life in this country, very fulfilling life. I've been rewarded for my efforts. I have had... What else can I hope for? I've got a nice home. I've got a nice home. Unit that I'm living is nice and clean. I've got nice clothes. And besides, all you got to bed at night and you're on your own, you can only look at one ceiling at a time. It wouldn't matter where you are. And if you are lonely, you can be just as lonely in a one-bedroom home or two-bedroom home and then a 10-bedroom home. You know, so I couldn't expect any more. I think I overcome all the difficulties of life. I'm still doing well for someone who has 7 stents in his heart, even though she's gone now 2 years since she left on the 23rd of September, 2013. Even though she's gone now, and she's with me every moment. It's never been a moment that she's not with me. And she's still with me every moment I come home, and I talk to her every morning when I wake up, and every evening when I go to sleep, and every day when I walk away and come back home. She's like never left me, and she will never leave me, because why would she leave me? She loved me too much to leave me anyway. Is it true? I think so. People who love you, they don't leave you behind. Okay.
Amal Awad speaking to Sam Petru in his barber shop in the western suburbs of Sydney. You've been listening to Life Matters. Thanks so much for your company. I'm Ellen Fanning.